Now it is pointed out once again for clarifying the path of the seeker. How one has got into bondage and what is the significance in the effort at the practice of yoga meditation. What is bondage from which you wish to be free? What is actually meant by this thraldom of samsara? How has it come about? Why is it that we are full of sorrow and we have no peace? This is mentioned in a single sutra, which states that the series of processes by which the individual soul has got into bondage consists nothing but of pains and pains, one after another, in various degrees of involvement. The common background of all schools of thought and philosophy, as far as the origin of bondage is concerned, is same, namely, ignorance of the true nature of things, avidya, ajnana, nishyans, etc., are the terms used to designate this condition. What actually exists is not known. This is called avidya. You cannot, by any amount of effort of the mind, understand what is actually there in front of you. And whatever you are seeing with your eyes or you think with your mind is not the true state of affairs. This is called avidya. You may logically argue, deduce, induce, all this is like the definitions given by the blind man who touched the elephant's different parts. Every school of thought is one blind man touching one part of truth and giving a partial definition of it, but never the whole of it. And so on account of a partial grasp of truth, there is a partial attitude to life, and everything follows from that, one after the other. This principle of bondage is the subject of the vital discussions in Buddhist psychology known as Pratitya Samutpada or dependent origination. Every chain, every link in the chain of bondage successively is dependent in one way or the other on the other link. And there is then a circular action of these links, one hitting upon the other, intensifying the other, and compelling the other to act more forcefully than it did earlier, so that it may look that we are becoming worse and worse every day rather than better on account of a peculiar psychological process that takes place, which it is difficult to fathom on account of involvement. Bondage is nothing but involvement, and not an ordinary type of involvement, a very, very complex type of it. So that there is attack from every side, and apparently there is no escape. The inability to perceive the true state of affairs the absence of an understanding of the correct relationship among things creates a false sense of values. And this sense of values is not merely an abstract imagination, but a solid metaphysical entity that crops up. Avidya is not absence of knowledge merely. Just as the expounders of the sutra tell us very humorously, the word amitra in Sanskrit means an enemy. But grammatically amitra means no friend, non-friend. A non-friend is not a non-existent person. He is a very existent enemy. Likewise, even as amitra does not mean absence of a friend, but the presence of an enemy, avidya does not mean absence of knowledge merely, but presence of a terrific foe in front of you. And it has a positivity of its own. It exists in a peculiar way which eludes grasp of understanding. So, a negative type of positivity is created, you may say, if you like, which is called the individuality, which asserts itself as a reality while it is based on a non-substantiality. The individuality of ours is unsubstantial, like vapor. It has no concrete element within it. It can be peeled off like onion and you will find nothing inside it. But yet it looks like a hard granite adamantine being on account of affirmation of consciousness. And the reality that is apparently visible in the individuality is borrowed from that which is really there. The support comes from that which really exists, which is true being. And this support is summoned for the purpose of substantiating something which is utterly false and wholly untenable. This untenable position is called self-assertion, affirmation, egoism, asmita, ahankara, etc. And all this has happened on account of not knowing correctly the interrelationship of things. There is a dependence of every factor on every other factor, so that individuality can have no ultimate value in the scheme of things. Because the very term individuality implies an isolated reality of a part of the cosmos. But this is ruled out entirely by the inner structure of things, which demand that every part hangs on some other for not only its existence and also its function. But the inability to grasp this truth is the cause of a hobgoblin that is in front of us, namely the individuality, the jivatva, and everything that follows from it. The asmita tattva that is mentioned as the effect of avidya is a centralization of consciousness, a focusing of it at a particular point in space and time, and a hardening of it into an adamantine substance, which gets encrusted more and more by repeated experience of self-contact, which confirm the false belief that the isolated existence of the individual is a reality. Namely, we get confirmation every day that our individuality is real due to the pleasure that we receive by sense contact. If our personal existence, the individuality, is not real, how comes pleasure, which is real? We live on the bank account of the pleasure that we derive by the contact of the senses with the objects outside. And every contact is an added confirmation of the notion within that our individuality is a substantial reality. And so we go on pursuing the pleasures with added zeal, greater enthusiasm and more vigor. This again adds a greater confirmation to the already existent notion that our individuality is real. So piles and piles of notions of this false individuality, asmita, get grouped together, and there is an impregnable fortress created in the form of what we are as individuals. And it looks that now the cart is before the horse. That which is real has become unreal, and that which is unreal has become real. The thing that has really evolved as an effect becomes the cause, as it were, and that which is the cause looks as if it is the effect. The cosmic substance out of which the individuals have evolved has become the object of the perception of the individuals, and the latter have taken the position, usurped the position of the cause of cognition, experience, etc. Notwithstanding the fact that they are evolutes, they have come further than the original substance which is cosmic, which is a very beautiful process described in the Aitareya Upanishad. How the cause can become the effect and the effect can become the cause by topsy-turvy position. And everything is in a state of confusion on account of this situation that has arisen. And there is a total misconstruing of all the features that rule this world. Conclusively, we may say that everything that you think is wrong thought. There is nothing like correct thinking as far as the reality of the individual is confirmed. Because the very basis is wrong, how can anything that proceeds from it be correct? This is the history of the production of asmita out of avidya. You can imagine how far and to what extent avidya is real from the direct experience of the extent of reality that you see in your own individuality, which is the asmita, the effect of avidya. How far are you real? From that you can judge the reality of avidya from where you have come. How solid and concrete are you in your individuality? How hard is the personality? How adamantine is the ego? How flint-like is our experience? From that we can understand how substantial avidya can be and must be, though it is ultimately an airy nothing. In one place, Swami Shivanji Maharaj has mentioned in a humorous way, the mind is something which is really nothing but does everything. The mind is something which is really nothing but does everything. This is the world. It is really not there, but it is terrible. That terrific character of it which is not there is due to something else that has taken place. There is a transposition of values on account of which the reality of unreal becomes possible. The character of the real is injected into the apparent formation of the unreal, and then the unreal looks like a reality. We transfer ourselves to the objects in our perception, and then it is the reality of the background of our being which is the cause for our belief in the reality of objects. All this is unknown because the causative background of our own individuality cannot be known by us. since we cannot climb on our own shoulders or look at our own back, see through our own eyes, etc. Because of the fact that the causes of our individual existence cannot be known by the faculties with which the individual is endowed, we are caught up in a confusion, a mess, which is a total disorder. So this kind of disorder, whose essence is in our individuality, asmita, is the product of avidya. And this concretized individuality of ours is the source of our loves and hatreds, likes and dislikes. The reason why we like certain things and dislike certain things is because of the sympathy which a peculiar structural pattern of an individual feels with the structure of certain groups of things outside, with which it gets related for the sake of a temporary feeling of completeness. No individual can be complete. Everything is a part. And therefore everything is restless and has to be restless. But this restlessness, the pain and the anguish felt by each partial experience of individuality tries to get a fulfillment by finding its counterpart in sensory experience. And inasmuch as the whole cosmos cannot be the counterpart of an individual, only certain elements which are projected by what is known as the prarabdha karma become the indicators of what is actually necessary for the fulfillment of individual wishes. This conditioning factor called the group of prarabdha becomes the projecting force, the motive power behind the type of desire that the individual manifests in respect of objects outside. So we may say our likes and dislikes are conditioned by our prarabdha karma. That is why everyone does not like everything. My likes are different from your likes, etc. The reason is that I, as an individual, am constituted of certain forces which do not relate themselves directly with every factor in the universe, because the prarabdha is a peculiar sample that is taken out of the entire resources behind us, called sanchita karma. And this sample is not the whole stock that is inside. It is only a little bit retail that is taken out for purpose of practical experience or transaction in the present life. So this little sample of prarabdha karma is concerned only with a particular type of experience. And therefore it selects out of the whole pattern of the universe certain objects which are directly connected with the limitations of its own individuality as sanctioned by the prarabdha. So there are varieties of likes and dislikes, and what I like you may dislike, so that you cannot know which object is the object of like, which one is the object of dislike. Generally speaking, anything can be the object of like of one and dislike of another. So there is no generalization of this feature. It is only the finding of one's counterpart. That which is ugly to me may be beautiful to you, and so on and so forth, because of your way of thinking, your needs of mind, etc. So this peculiar effect that further follows from asmita or individuality in the form of the pulls and repulsions, raga and dvesha, adds a further confirmation once more to our belief that the world is real, the body is real, individuality is real, all our phenomenal experiences are real. Already the fire has been ignited by the presence of the asmita, and now the flame is burning, and it becomes more and more consuming and vehement by the winds of desire that blow over it. The fire becomes a flame, and having become uncontrollable by the tempestuous movements of the desire for objects of sense, there is a tossing of the individual from one end to another in search of the pleasures of sense, which is the world of Radha Dvesha active Udara Avastha, or the fully expanded condition of the active mind in respect of its objects of pleasure. So you can imagine how we get into bondage more and more every day. We go deeper and deeper into the quagmire. The quagmire is a peculiar kind of mire, where if you keep foot, you will go in. And if you try to lift one foot, the other foot will go. You cannot get out of it. That is called quagmire. Such is this world, where once you get in, you cannot come out. And how many difficulties follow from this? The confirmed belief in the substantiality of our phenomenal experiences subtly creates a feeling of fear in us simultaneously, which is contrary to the apparent belief in the reality of things. Why are we afraid of things? The fear is due to the subtle feeling of the possibility of one's being wrenched out of one's contact with objects of sense. The fear of death is nothing but the fear of loss of pleasure. I may lose all my centers of pleasure if the forces of death come and catch out of my throat. The love of life, which is so inherent in every individual, accompanied with the fear of death, is another form of love of pleasure. Otherwise, why should one fear death so much? Because the so-called phenomenal relationship created by the asmita have created the impression that there are centers of joy here and they are the only reality. There is nothing beyond. Can anyone imagine even the furthest stretch of thought that there is any delight possible or even conceivable beyond the pleasures of sense? There is nothing conceivable. We only imagine intellectually, academically, but practically there is none. Everything is included within sense pleasure. They are everything. This peculiar involvement of the individual is what is known as the bondage of the jiva. And more detailed explanations of the various minor links in this chain of involvement are given in Buddhist psychology, and as I mentioned to you, in the philosophy known as Pratipya Samutpada, which amounts to saying finally that you have only to take the first step in the direction of mistake and then everything will follow. You shall be taken care of. You will be pushed afterwards automatically. And one push is given to you, then another push will follow. Then the third and the fourth and the fifth and 12 pushes are given to you, says Buddha. So that now you are in the 12th push. So that you are in the deepest nether region of the utterest form of sorrow, in the most formidable condition of involvement, utterly incapable of understanding, but yet giving the impression that it is the only reality. So we are fools of the first order at present, according to this psychological analysis. Though we look so wise, and there is no wonder that yoga should be very difficult to practice for such fools as we are. How is it possible? Because the involvement is so intense, and you have to remove the incrustations one after another gradually. So for the uninitiated and uninformed souls who have not yet been able to grasp directly by vision the truths of things, Patanjali goes on to give a series of prescriptions for the freeing of one's consciousness from such involvements by graduated technique, graduated practice. A sudden directing of the mind on meditation is not possible, because the layers are hard enough, they cannot be pierced through at once. Also, the layer of bondage, which has manifested itself in a series, is not placed one above the other in a linear fashion, like piles of paper kept one over the other, but they are intricately involved, one getting into the fiber of the other, as it were, and you cannot peel one layer out without causing pain to the other layer that is underneath. Because of the involvement of consciousness, vitality, in every layer, there is suffering involved a little bit in the peeling out of the layer. Just as you feel pain when you peel the skin. You know that skin is not your real nature. But yet why do you feel pain when you are peeled out? Because you have become one with the skin, one with the bone and marrow, flesh, everything. And likewise, every layer of bondage has become part of the self. So that the removal of the bondage is not desirable. It looks pleasurable for the soul. Bondage itself has become a source of joy. So that you can say that the very vision of there being something beyond in the form of freedom has got out of one's vision. If a person is a captive in a jail for 50, 60 years, he may take that as a natural way of living. He has been in the jail for 60 years. He has been used to that way of living, and he cannot think of any other value or reality other than that. And in a similar manner, there is an accustoming of consciousness to a life of bondage, and conditions, limitations and restrictions have been regarded as a type of freedom itself. Even the limitation that has been imposed upon you, you mistake for freedom. And the pain that follows is regarded as joy. The pleasures of sense are not really pleasure. This is the point that will be mentioned in one of the sutras following. They are pains which are misread as pleasures. There is a misconstruing of structure in the reading of meaning in the contact of senses with objects. There is a total misreading of the whole value. You read the things topsy-turvy, as it were. Just as when you look at your face in a mirror, the right looks left, left looks right. You don't think, see things properly. There is a complete reversal of values taking place in the judgment of the mind in respect of its contact with objects. The reactions that are produced by the contact of senses with objects are called the pleasures of sense. But these reactions are very peculiar things. They are difficult to understand why these reactions are set up at all. And because of something else inscrutable present in this process, this reaction is mistaken for a desirable feeling. And because the feeling has been already called desirable, designated as desirable, it has to be called pleasurable. It is an intense tension that one feels in the process of this reaction that is created at the time of the contact of the subject with the object. And you know, every tension is a pain. If you are placed in a condition of utter limitation from every side, you feel unhappy. And any kind of lifting of this tension, even a modicum of it, will appear as the removal of a burden from your head, a load taken away from you, and the mere absence of nervous tension inside can look like a positive happiness. While what has happened is simply that the tense nerves have been relieved due to a particular action that has taken place biologically and psychologically. It is difficult to know why we feel happiness, why there is pleasure at all in sense contact, unless we know the anatomy of perception itself. Why is it that we are seeing objects? What is it that compels us or drives us towards objects? And where is the need for us to come in contact with things? If the history and the anatomical background of this situation is properly grasped, we may also be able to know to some extent why it is that we wrongly mistake pain for pleasure, and how it is that we can get befooled by the senses in creating a notion of falsehood, that a negative reaction, which is merely a little bit of freedom from tension of nerves, can look like a positive bliss. It is the inability to grasp these things that has created an impression that bodily experiences and the phenomenal processes are independent by themselves, a reality taken by themselves. This is the essence of bondage, and how difficult it is to get out of it is clear on the very surface of it. Hari Om Tat Sat.